It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly on today's multiple. I'm Matthew Soucy, host of Film Sociology, and things have just gone disarray from the get-go.
What happened to Scott Hoke?
Okay, here's the story. Let me at least get through. Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point.
Hola, bienvenidos al punto.
And WFYI.org, and apparently HD3 on television. If you have a question or a comment, like, what the hell just happened? Go to msoci@wfyi.org. Also on Facebook. Also on Twitter @MatthewSoci. The show is available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. And we have a blog, which you can read at filmsociology.tumblr.com. Okay, yeah, so you're not hearing any of the intro music, and you're not hearing any of Kobe Slagle or Scott Hoke. And part of the reason why is, full disclosure, Kobe Slagle is getting married on Sunday, so congratulations.
Yay.
to
congratulations.
Kobe and his fair sweet Bianca, who of course was now her office has been shut as the Twilight correspondent. We'll find some other cruddy literature for her to be. And Monica, yeah, so you guys can fight over the job. However, now everybody's wondering who's here in studio. Well, I get more bang for my buck. I have Terry Garr and Tony Randall, not named Mike Perry, but I have an intro. I played it before. And I've already enhanced it. Just I know, shocking.
Yes.
There's more of this, so I think you'll recognize this. Hold on.
It's called Inception.
Brian Hartz is in studio.
I think you could have gotten just one more of those.
One more.
Probably. One more. And, of course, his lovely wife, Monica, who are hanging out with me. A woman who loves to see things get pulled out of Keira Knightley, and we won't talk about her favorite Guy Ritchie film. So we're just going to keep moving on after really 1 minute of radio self-indulgence that is Hans Zimmer. So.
Well, it already feels like this is turning into an episode of Inside Joke Radio. So.
Oh, from the get-go. See, this is what happens when you don't have a proper engineer. It just goes and turns out like this show. So, Brian, you have a soundtrack blog, which you can check out at
cinematicmusic.blogspot.com.
Anything new this week?
Not this week.
But we're working. Now that I've brought it up on the radio, there'll be something new next week.
Yeah, probably.
Yes.
Just keep an eye out. Keep an eye out.
There you go. Okay, so we're in the midst of, it's now September. It's now getting cooler. We are now in the post, for me, the end of summer happens really with Penrod. Once Penrod is done, it's time to fall up.
And the weather actually, like, physically changed last night when that cold front blew in. It was crazy.
So we're starting to get into some grown-up movies, but not quite this week. However, over at IU Cinema today, they're showing Only God Forgives, the latest Ryan Gosling film directed by Nicholas Winding Refn. I hope I'm saying it right. But, of course, that's the gentleman who gave us Drive, one of my favorite car films of the last several decades, and there you can see an interview with Joe Shearer of the Film Yap in today's Not Nouveau, and you can also probably check it out at the Film Yap. They know I say that.
It still cracks me up.
The Indianapolis Star, I know. But anyway,
newspaper of record,
and the Indianapolis Star. No, and of course Nicholas has directed Valhalla Rising, Drive, and of course Bronson, which inflicted the world of everyone's favorite Batman villain.
Tom Hardy.
Not to be confused with Thomas Hardy, author of Jude the Obscure and Tess of the D'Urbervilles.
That's true. Monica, you all right? Are you with us?
I'm good. I drifted a little bit.
You didn't think Tom was delicious in Dark Knight Rises, did you?
No, that mask is a little too weird for my taste.
And his Sean Connery voice.
Yeah, that was a little...
I don't know what you're talking about.
A little bit like
Brian Hart's impressionist. Also the Frank Caliendo of film sociology. No, he's smarter than that. Okay, so...
Also cuter.
Much cuter. So we got two films that opened here in Indianapolis. I know Short Term 12 opened, and hopefully we will be able to check that out. I know that did get a Truly Moving Pictures stamp of approval, but we're going to start with a film I got to see last week called Austinland with plucky Carrie Russell. That should really be a... You were talking... somebody referred to
it was from Nouveau, actually.
Oh, really? From the actual Nouveau?
Yeah, they said it was predictably plucky.
Oh, yes. Ed Johnsonat, my colleague and I... And we have a fun story about that screening. And I would normally play the trailer, but, you know, look how well-prepared I am already. Basically, this is Carrie Russell is a woman, probably, I assume, she's in her 30s. We have no idea what she does for a living. But apparently it's something that requires her enough to buy enough stuff in her house. She's obsessed with the work of Jane Austen.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And Mr. Darcy / Colin Firth, steady mom. But yeah, but her room and her apartment, it would be like Colin Firth's version of Silence of the Lambs. It looks like Miss Bill's. It's all over the place. You know, the full cardboard cutout of him and everything Austin and stuff on the... Yeah, I mean, it's just all over the... It's a combination, I think, of The King of Comedy and Silence of the Lambs when it comes to just stocky, scary apartment. She has this. And she's decided to blow all of her money into a place in England for a vacation called Austinland. So basically, ladies and gentlemen... Chick Flicks now has their own version of Westworld, basically. It's it is done up like an old traditional Austonian castle. It's run by Jane Seymour. Nice to see Jane again. Haven't seen her since, I think, The Wedding Crashers. And
She was in that.
And she runs this place with an iron fist. No electronics, no modern stuff. You have to dress the part. You have to act the part. You have to sew. So if you're a lady, apparently, in this, you get to be wooed by men, but you also have to sew a lot. Yes, and walk in the gardens. And also, you had a different social strategy.
So it's more like a dude ranch, actually.
It's kind of a babe ranch, I guess. So, yeah. Welcome to Misogyny Radio. But yeah, it is kind of a dude ranch for ladies who love Jane Austen. So, and because she, of course, has the lowest package, so she has a peasant hotel room, which, you know what, from a bed and breakfast standpoint, I don't think it's that bad. Mm-hmm. But, of course, it's supposed to look that way, especially compared to somebody who is in the platinum area. And, of course, she's played by Jennifer Coolidge, who... We like Jennifer Coolidge, but she is basically recycled, I think, several of her characters from Christopher Guest films. She plays an abrasive rich woman who wants to be a part of this, speaks with the horrible accent, and tries way too hard to sound British.
Yeah.
And, of course, is because she is rich, is the target of many of the men. Yeah, right.
Wait, so is this like, do they, like... Are you just going to, like, leave? Is it just for while you're on vacation that you're flirting with these guys? Or is
this,
like, potential?
Yes, no, that's the thing. There's that they're hired to do this. This is their job.
That's weird.
Little weird. Because, you know, if we did this, if we went to this, if guys went to something like this, I think it would be rated. But it's in England. It's okay.
And it's for women.
It is for women. So, and, of course, what happens is that two separate characters... One, of course, the Mr. Darcy-esque character, and then a gentleman who is steady, huh? And of course, a guy who works there. He works the stables. There's a really odd kind of City Slickers-esque scene where he delivers a baby horse. Don't read the baby horse equus as a bedtime story. Let's not do that.
Sorry.
Wow. And so the... quote-unquote peasant girl that the Carrie Russell's character becomes winds up getting an Austonian experience by two men chasing after her.
Mm-hmm.
So there, and I know my colleague Ed Johnsonat wrote a pretty scathing review of it in this week's Nouveau. I'm not going to do ratings because I don't do ratings, but I think I liked it slightly more than Ed, but that's not saying a whole heck of a lot. It's kind of like being stuck in a less obnoxious Renaissance fair. With this film, there are moments where you get the – it has the true Austonian feel. I love the Austonian. You can say that on NPR, Austonian. It's like Dickensian. And
yes.
So there are moments that it does capture the spirit of the Jane Austen novels, especially with Carrie Russell dealing with the two men. That's fine.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of times where everything is really played to a broad, wide audience, like the Jennifer Coolidge character. Well, by the way, if you're in traditional Austen garb and you hear a pop song, apparently that's funny. You check out the closing credits with this film, which is there's a scene where there is a song that the only song that Carrie Russell can play on the piano is a certain R&B tune that has lyrics about taking your clothes off. That's funny because it's from a different era and they're dressed differently.
Wow.
But it's not a Knight's Tale.
Anachronism.
Right. Wow. So.
Who would ever have thought to use that for comedy?
Exactly. So I wish that they hadn't dumbed it down for the audience.
Yeah.
I think if they had kept it more Austen, and no, they didn't need to have Yul Brynner come in. Thank you.
That's too
second,
bad.
Second Westworld reference in 12 minutes. Yeah. Love this show.
Well, if your Twilight correspondent were not indisposed, she might be able to inform you that this was in fact produced by Stephanie.
Oh
Meyer,
yeah, that's right.
Which might explain.
It explains
of the,
a little bit
narrative difficulties.
Yeah, but those people look like they're having fun.
Well, okay.
Nobody in Twilight ever looks like they're having
fun. They're smiling and having a good time on this.
You can't smile when you're angsty.
Says who? John Lennon.
Yeah.
But there are moments. So there's even a play within the play, which I guess Jane Austen also is a fan of William Shakespeare because they also have to perform in a play that was performed. It was really written by the Jane Seymour character. And, of course, when you have a stage play in a movie, bad things happen.
Usually.
Usually. So, but it's shorter than Noises Off in that aspect. So, yeah, it's kind of a little all over the place. I wish, if they had stuck more with the Austen story and less with the nonsense for the mall crowd, I think we would have had a better picture.
I find that that's the truth most of the time. When you have a concept and you dumb it down for a wider audience, it just doesn't...
And a whiter audience, really.
Yeah. I mean, and it's not just
a
film, but...
How can you get more white
than Jane Austen? No, it's just it often ends up failing as opposed to succeeding.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, even a quote-unquote wider audience can tell when you've half-butted something.
Right. So I think I... half-butted. As opposed to full-butted.
Yeah.
Well, Monica, you're 14 minutes in and you got your nugget for the week. Thank you very much. Nice to see you.
We believe in you.
Yeah, no, Sam. I need you. I can't do a 45
minute. Don't leave.
I can't do a 45 minute monologue, and really, nobody wants that. So, all right. So, I guess the Jane Austen audience, and I'll get to them in a little bit, they probably would say this to me about what I felt about the film.
Shut up! My God! You have no freaking life!
Yeah. Because I dare say that this film is not that great. Okay, now the screening of this. We had a press screening of this at Landmark Keystone Art Cinemas on the north side last Friday. And it was 11 o'clock in the morning, and I love these because as a film critic, we are spoiled. We love to have the entire theater to ourselves and don't have to deal with texting or babies or loud people or drunk people or whatever. So
You're not drunk at 11 in the morning?
Shh, no. You work different hours than I do, sweetheart. So, yeah, we're not going to talk about that. Okay. So I go to the screening. I get to the theater about 10:45, and there's Ed Johnson out, my buddy at Nuvo. And you could read Ed's fun review of Austen Land in Nuvo and Nuvo.net. And we look, and there's about 30 women hanging out in front of the theater, in front of the doors. And we thought, well, it's 10:45. The mall, I guess some of the shops are open, not all, but some. And, well, they're not walking. And these are ladies of different age ranges. They range from younger than Monica to older than me, and much older than me, and double my age. So, I'm like, what are they doing? And so finally we come inside the theater, and I talk to the manager. I'm like, where are the ladies, and where are their red hats and purple jackets?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no. They were not the red hat ladies, nope. The red hat squad. They also fight Al Capone and the gangsters. But no, this was a group, the Indianapolis chapter of the Jane Austen Book Club.
Wow. All right.
Yes. So, well, that makes sense.
And that does make sense.
Not to be confused with the Jane Austen book club film with Maria Bello. That's another thing. But yes, of course. So you get the target audience. You let them see it for free. I've seen this happen many times in the past. I remember, you know, all the of course, the bus people from the churches to go see The Passion of the Christ. The people who hadn't seen a movie in like 20 years because all movies are trash until they saw as Ed Johnson Ott called it, a biblical snuff film.
It was. It was.
So there's that. And then there was the number of Greek Orthodox churches that came to see My Big Fat Greek Wedding. So, you know, I get it. That was fine. It was funny. It was very entertaining. Somebody brought their baby. There was a one-month-old. And Ed and I didn't sit together on this one physically. But I don't want to be the guy that kind of, you know. Because it's technically a private screening, but somebody brought a kid. And I don't, you know, what do you do? Now, much to the mother's and the baby's credit, there was a little fussing before the movie started, and then nothing.
That's
I don't know if it was, you know, nursing or fell asleep or both, but
probably,
you know,
both.
Roofies.
Yeah, maybe. But you know,
one month. It's a little young.
That's a little young. I mean,
you don't have to use much.
Thank you. Parenting skills with Brian Hartz. There we go. You can also read his book and mine. I Drink Because You Cry. But I did say to the mom, I'm a, you know, way to dodge a bullet on that one on behalf of humanity. Thank you
thank you.
The baby fell asleep. And of course, which was my way of saying, don't ever bring a child to a movie again until they're old enough. But you know, so there was these women and they all knew each other and they're hoping there would be previews, even though it was a press screening. And you know, Ed made a point of saying, and I can't remember if he said this in a review, this audience seems like the type that would applaud after a movie. And they didn't.
Oh.
Ooh.
Right. And so, and I got to think about people who clap in a movie because the actors are not going to burst through this. It's not Purple Rose of Cairo. They're not going to burst on the screen and take a bow.
Yeah.
You do that in live theater, not movie theater. So anyway, it was just kind of amusing. We hadn't really thought of this group. And it reminded me of when I had to go to the press screening of Watchmen, also known as Billy Crudup's Giant Blue Thing. Steady, Monica. So it was.
I really wasn't that into. I've never really been that into Billy Crudup.
That's really okay. It was downtown. It was Monday morning, 10 o'clock, and so there's the usual suspects: the film critics, the Film Yap guys, and Ed and myself, and a few others, and then Abdul Hakim Shabazz, who's a big comic guy who works, and then there were about 70 people that apparently were kind of high rollers at the downtown comic book store, with one woman, very popular. And Abdul had a great kind of quiet rant around us. It was like Lee Elia's rant about the Cubs in 1983, about Cub fans. They're like, what are these people doing at 10 o'clock in the morning on a Monday? I know why I'm here. I know why you guys are here. Why aren't these guys working?
Mm-hmm.
So it was nice to see the moms and grandmoms of the Watchmen audience at the screening last week.
Nice.
Honey, I'm going to go see Austin Land. Make sure you get an application in. All right.
Well, he's probably just watching Watchmen on
again,
the living room TV.
Probably.
Yeah.
Again. The director's
cut. For like the 57 millionth time.
Director's cut.
Yeah.
And then to lighten things up, Sucker Punch.
Yeah.
Yeah, nobody asked for that. Okay, so that's out. Also opening today, The Family. Not a movie of the 70s TV show with Christy McNichol. This has The in front of it. So get your title straight. But this is one, it's Robert De Niro, Michelle Pfeiffer, Tommy Lee Jones. And it's De Niro and Pfeiffer are a mob family. He has turned turncoat against his family, and he is on the witness protection program. His contact played by Tommy Lee Jones, because who would you rather have to make sure things are stern and going in the right direction? And
he found Richard Kimball.
He did find Richard Kimball, and he didn't care if he didn't murder his wife.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, but this time around, the film begins. They are in Normandy. They have apparently bounced from several different locations for different problems. And this is at a point in De Niro's career where it seems like he is just doing a. I mean, there was that period in the aughts where it looked like he was just kind of doing movies so he could finance the Tribeca Film Festival. If you look at some of those films from the last decade, that there's a, it's what we call a rough patch.
Yeah.
It's
what I call autopilot.
Yeah, kind of autopilot. Kind of, it was like Olivier in the 70s, so we can get the National Theater up and going. I get it. I understand. It's painful to watch,
but
I get it.
He had a deep artistic commitment to the jazz singer.
Yeah. Oh, jeez. I have no son. And of course, De Niro got a nomination last year for Silver Linings Playbook. But it seems like in the last few years, he's doing films not just for the paycheck, but for a chance to work with others. Of course, he reteamed with Pacino in Righteous Kill, and that wasn't very good. He was in a film earlier this year called The Big Wedding, because he got to work with Diane Keaton and Susan Sarandon mm-hmm. and Katherine Heigl and Robin Williams. So I get it. It's, you know, people and of course they're actors of a certain age. So maybe the more of those you get together, the better chance you have. And that this sort of has that feel a little bit. He's never worked with Pfeiffer. I don't think he's ever worked with Tommy Lee Jones. What's interesting, and I didn't know this until last week, this is a film that's co-written and directed by Luc Besson.
Really?
Yes. So I thought, we'll see what Luc Besson
does.
Yeah,
that intrigues me.
He can be real hit and miss with his projects. So the first two-thirds of this film, as I described it, sounds like a darker version of My Blue Heaven.
That's exactly what I was thinking about.
It kind of is, because and of course they have a boy and a girl, and I can't remember the boy. Of course, the girl is the blonde cheerleader in Glee, she's 27 playing a high schooler.
Yeah, that was kind of like Maggie Grace and Taken.
Little bit. Yeah, there's a few. I think there's a list of child actors, well, actually adult actors, some of the oldest actors.
Who, like, their expertise is playing much younger.
Right, like,
people.
I believe the actor who played Hannah Montana's brother was, like, 31. So, there's that, and then in kind of Bessonian. In Bessonian fashion, the New York crime family, who De Niro ratted out, finds a way of finding out where his family is. And it's a huge stretch, a major stretch. It involves the school newspaper in Normandy, France, that the Sun writes for.
Wow.
Yeah. This is a little...
Is it, like, implausible to the point that it pulled you out of the movie?
It did pull me out. It really did. And it reminded me of the two plot points in The Place Beyond the Pines, which came out earlier this year, and the Clint Eastwood... Remember the Clint Eastwood film Hereafter? The Matt Damon...
Oh, yeah, the confusing afterlife kind of...
Right, and you had to have three separate storylines all meet at the book convention. Kind of like that. I'm like, that's just a little too far out of my reach to go with that. Mm. So then when that happens, then it turns into big, dumb action movie. And that's a bit of a bummer. That's a bit of a letdown. I expect action from a Besson film. I understand.
Well, but his is usually smart action.
It was for about two-thirds.
Okay.
And then this major... My first thing was... If you're gonna do a darker version of My Blue Heaven, I guess keep it that way. I'm sure there's organized crime in the south of France. Nobody, of course, will admit to that. But maybe if the family had to deal with the local family, that could have been something a little more interesting.
Yeah.
Than seriously, it was like the I don't think I'm really giving anything away, but the Sun writes a bit in a school paper that somehow gets into the hands of a mobster who's in prison. Right. Exactly. Well,
is he in prison in France?
No, he's in prison in New York.
What?
Exactly. That's
that makes
saying.
No sense.
Well, they try to justify it, but it was kind of a big red X Family Feud style for me. Acting wise is fine. It's not a ridiculous over the top action scene. Although a little bit, although four people against a mob of like a dozen.
Andre the Giant could have done it.
Andre the Giant's dead, unfortunately. But however, he's still drinking barrels of wine as we know it.
Mm-hmm.
And more power to him.
Yes, more power to him. So save some for us. But yeah, it was kind of a letdown. I think if it had stayed as a darker version of My Blue Heaven, and even if you do have the four against the world, that one plot point really pulled me out of it.
Yeah, and that's one of those things that if it's that bad, it's really hard to kind of recover, honestly.
Yeah.
So,
and that's a shame. That's a shame. So there's that, and I'm sure Luc Besson would also say, "Oh man, This isn't working.
Shut!
Maybe he would say exactly that.
My God! You have no freaking life!
I think it's overrated.
Shut up, you!
Yeah.
That sounds creepy.
That's Emma.
She sounded a little creepy.
Great, I'll tell her you said that.
In a good way.
Oh, in a good, okay, good. Oh boy. So yeah, those are the movie reviews for today. That's what's new in theaters. We're going to take a short break and we'll talk about what is new and old on DVD and Blu-ray, and we'll talk more with Brian and Monica and just try to land this puppy in the water like Apollo 13. You're listening
Woo!
To Thanks. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org.
I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's a real program.
That's my all-time favorite ID. I have lots of them. I have them here, right here in front of me. But the fact that Elmore Leonard said, this is a real show.
And he was a real writer.
He was a real writer. So I really appreciated that. So thank you, Elmore. Oh, while we're at it, I think you'll like this.
Hi, this is Padma Lakshmi, and you're listening to Film Sociology on WFYI FM radio.
That's right.
Starting to sound
hey
like
there, it's Ted Allen from
spot.
Chopped on the Food Network, and you are listening to Film Sociology with Matthew Soucy on WFYI Indianapolis.
Wow.
I know. This is the name-dropping portion of Film Sociology.
I like this.
Hi, I'm Lydia Bastianich, and you're listening to Film Sociology on WFYI.
So bad.
Got any more to drop?
Oh, sure. Lots of them.
Hi, this is Rich Coase, and I just wanted you to know that you're listening to Film Sociology on WFYI Indianapolis.
Nice.
It could have been in Berwyn, but it isn't.
Well, hello there. My name is Zalmonti Tombstone from the Sven Gulit program on MeTV, and I wanted to advise you that you're listening to Film Sociology on WFYI Indianapolis. I flunked sociology, so good luck.
We can do this till 6 o'clock. This is not bad.
Oh, no.
Hey, everyone. This is Tommy Wiseau, and you're listening now to Film Sociology at the WFYI Indianapolis.
The WFYI.
It is like the Ball State University.
Yes.
I like that.
Hello,
everyone. My name is F. Murray Abraham. You're listening to Film Sociology, WFYI Indianapolis.
Nice.
Or, as his friends call him, F.
No, he let me call him Murray.
Ooh, wow.
Yeah, it was a little Chris Farley show, Mona. Really?
Really?
Hey, guys, I'm Molly Sims, and you're listening to Film Sociology on
nice.
WFYI in Indianapolis.
Wife.
Me, Mrs. Soucy.
What?
Huh?
What? Wife?
No, the setup on that was I got to interview Molly Sims for like 5 minutes. It was one of those short things, and she had a new website about fashion design and health and all that, and she's talking to me. And I was informed by Molly Sims, I need to juice more. And I said, okay, fair enough. And, you know, like, green juice is real. And I said, great, you sound like Mrs. Soucy. And she said, call me Mrs. Soucy. And of course, my brain went, oh, you shouldn't have said that.
Yeah.
Because now you're a part of this.
Hey, guys, I'm Molly Sims, and you're listening to Film Sociology on WFYI in Indianapolis. Hey, Mrs. Sosie.
I get it.
This is Kevin Murphy from Mystery Science Theater 3000 and Riff Tracks. And in case you didn't know it, and you probably should, you are listening to Film Sociology on WFYI.
Okay, last one, because then we got to move on. Because this guy will be in studio next week.
This is Sammy Terry being terrorized with you, with Film Sociology. Have many pleasant nightmares.
The son of Sam.
Yeah,
yes.
Different Sam. But yeah, actually, I take that back. He's going to be on in 2 weeks because I know he's got a live show coming up outside of Indy. So, okay, I'm here with Brian and Monica Hartz hanging out while I just completely play with audio because I just got to get this at 6 o'clock.
I love hearing you play with audio.
Thank you.
The releases are a little slim this week, aren't they?
What? Yeah, it's kind of thin because, you know, I had two disappointing films in theaters, and we look and, okay, the big title, because nobody wanted to compete with this, and I get it.
Yeah.
But nobody wanted to compete with the DVD Blu-ray release of Star Trek Into Darkness.
Yeah, you don't want to try to compete with that.
No, and I wish I could write down, I should have written down what other films opened that same week as Star Trek, because I know, I don't think they did well, if I recall.
Well, I remember we saw Iron Man 3.
It was
3.
May.
It was we.
Flashback noises. That's good.
But like it was crazy because they all happened. They didn't. A lot of the big name movies didn't happen that week. There was like Iron Man 3. It was literally like the week before, and then After Earth I think was the week after Star Trek. But nobody opened. None of the big ones opened with it.
Yeah. So. Anyway, that opened. Now, you two have not seen it, right?
We have not.
That's
no.
Okay. Well, it's out on DVD and Blu-ray. You can check it out.
All right.
This was a film I know. It was much anticipated. I really enjoyed the first one. It was fun seeing new faces with familiar characters.
And Carl Urban's uncanny
tankless bastard.
I mean, I was thoroughly impressed by Zachary Quinto as Spock as well.
Yeah,
I mean,
everybody did. I really enjoyed it. I think it was enough time had passed, obviously, that it was worth it. And, of course, J.J. Abrams was involved. So we get this one, and I don't think I'm really giving away a whole lot, but I'm wondering now, are we just remaking the original Star Trek film series? Because, big shocker, Khan is in this one.
Yeah.
And it's not Ricardo Montalban, it's Sherlock Holmes.
Benedict Cumberbatch.
Great English.
I think
his name also works at Austin Land, but...
Yeah.
Bandicoot Crumblebum.
Right. And he's fine, but it's
Boomerang Camisole.
Are you coming up with your own Dickensian Austrian names?
No,
your
English
just like your spins English on Benedict Cumberbatch.
Oh, okay. Yes. Lovely.
Yes. Some of Benedict's aliases.
Great. So go to a hotel in London, you might, I don't know.
Yeah.
So the fact that he's in this and
Carlos Danger.
That's It is not that, nor is it Ron Mexico.
Ron Mexico.
Thank you, Michael Vick. So I wonder now if it's going to be, I mean, are we going to search for Spock in the next film?
No, I actually, sorry, I didn't mean to.
No, it's fine.
I read an article about that, and I think it was, I can't remember who they were talking to. It might have been J.J. Abrams, actually, or... one of the actors, great reference, Monica. But they were saying that they knew that's how it was going to feel. They were, when they got done making it, they were very aware. People will say this and they will assume that is what's happening. Mm-hmm. And like, they're saying that it was like they're kind of using it as a transition point. Like they did the first one and then this, and then they're going to try
great.
To
great. So this is Star Trek's Quantum of Solace, basically.
But Quantum of Solace was really bad. This wasn't bad, was it?
It was disappointing. It was for me. I don't think brawn should outdo brains in a Star Trek show, even in a J.J. Abrams version.
No.
Amen.
And yes, Spock gets a moment, and he gets the moment involving Khan, a piece of verbiage that we all know and love, and it made some audience members cheer, and it made us old people feel really old. But it just felt like some of the shine had come off this apple because we liked the first Star Trek so much.
Yeah, the success of that was kind of a bad setup for a sequel because you have all of this, oh my gosh, it was so awesome, and there's really hardly any way you can meet that kind of expectation.
Yes.
Well, for a franchise that's all about the undiscovered and the joy of new exploration and everything, to be retreading old ground, just, I don't know.
Well, there's something to be said about the mall crowd that doesn't go to the center of the video store, if there were video stores left, so...
Yeah, there's still a Family Video in our neighborhood.
There is.
And there's one in mine, so we'll just kind of... But anyway, I understand, but I just wasn't crazy about it. So that was a bit of a letdown for me. I'm sorry, you were...
Nope.
No, okay.
Nope, go ahead.
Just making sure. So the film that decided to go up against Star Trek on DVD and Blu-ray, I wound up not watching. And it was Tyler Perry Presents Peoples. Now, I think... He is not even a producer on this. I think it's one where he just gets the present title.
He kind of gets the credit.
Right. So it is with Craig Robinson, David Alan Grier, and it's kind of basically an African-American version of Meet the Parents.
Wow.
Because the reverse version of Guess Who with Ashton Kutcher and Bernie Mac apparently wasn't enough.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
I remember that. That was really unfortunate.
Sorry. That was very unfortunate.
Oh, well. Tyler Perry, a cottage industry unto himself.
So instead, I was like, well, do I have time to
see
Peoples?
They didn't even write it.
Well, all right.
Yeah. But, as long as it's got a stamp. Well, you know if there's a name of it. And it's kind of like what Quentin did. Whenever it was Quentin Tino Presents.
Oh, yeah.
Like Switchblade Sisters and some of the Hong Kong. Yeah, there was going to be an automatic audience that were going to go check
it's
that out.
True.
Early Eli Roth stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's what I need. I want the Matthew Soucy Presents pull.
There you go.
We've got to work on that.
Yeah.
It'll be a sitcom for you two on Bravo.
Yay!
The real arts couple of Indianapolis.
Yes.
So instead of Peoples, I decided to give it a shot. It was not a theatrical release, and yet I tried to get off my high horse and say, yes, I actually saw this, even though it's an HBO film, but it seemed more intriguing. I watched Phil Spector, starring Al Pacino, Helen Mirren, Jeffrey Tambor's in this. Chiwetel Ejiofor has a nice cameo.
That sounds like a fantastic cast.
And it's written and directed by David Mamet.
I love Mamet.
Sold.
Yeah, exactly. So it intrigues me that this is a film. This and Steven Soderbergh's Beyond the Candelabra, which was also for HBO, couldn't get a theatrical release or didn't want to get a theatrical release, depending on who you're talking to.
Well, yeah, because they'd have to go through the MPAA to get that, and that's a hassle.
Right, and I think also the subject matter on this.
And then the David Mamet script, of course.
And the David Mamet script. But they've done Mamet scripts before. I will say this. You know, you have to give Mamet credit because the man has, how should I say, the man has brass onions. He really, really, because that's what you need to sell real estate, as we learned from Glengarry Glen Ross.
And Alec Baldwin.
Mm-hmm.
Still Alec Baldwin's finest moment in cinema. Period.
Absolutely.
And the dude's got a nomination and some Emmy wins. But no, this is it. This film, Phil Spector, I think is David Mamet's version of Reversal of Fortune. Because Helen Mirren, I'm trying to remember her character. I mean, first off, it starts with that this is a fictional film. Because we know every other film is based on a true story, inspired by a true story, and Mamet tells you right off the bat, this is not.
Mm-hmm.
There are people that we're familiar with, like Spector and the lawyers and the judge and all that sort of thing. But no, this is a work of fiction. And what Mamet does, and I think this is probably one of the reasons why it probably wouldn't have done well at the multiplexes, is that it tries to humanize Phil Spector.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some folks don't want to see that.
This sounds like fan fiction based on real life.
Probably. Linda Baden was the Helen Mirren character, who at the beginning of the film, she comes in and is going to help out for a day or two. She's sick as a dog, but decides to and doesn't really want to do it, and makes a point of saying, you know, courts let the jury let off OJ, the jury let off Michael Jackson. They're not going to let this guy off. And she winds up meeting with Phil Spector, played by Al Pacino, with various wigs, of course. And this weird connection, of course, happens, and she winds up sticking with the case. I mean, it's a good cast. It does have the machine gun dialogue that we expect from a Mamet film. But it also addresses fame, who's guilty, who's innocent. and it really doesn't soften the Phil Spector image. This is a guy that, you know, shot a gun in a recording studio and had multiple stories of women who said that they were held against their will, brandished a pistol. You know, you hear stories, you know, you heard stories with John Lennon in studio and other musicians. But the point is, and there's a scene where a woman comes up to Helen Mirren's character and kind of berates her for defending this man. And basically she says, he's not guilty in this case. Mm-hmm. And of course her response, the woman's response is, what about with the next girl?
Yeah.
So it does bring up stuff about the legal system that maybe we do like or don't like, but again, it's his reversal of fortune. He's not in full blown screamy mode as we've expected from Pacino in the last 20 years.
Pretty much.
But there are moments, and it builds to an interesting climax, and it's a rehearsal that, you know, because the big question is whether you put him on the witness stand or not.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was the other thing. Those photos of him in court with the wigs, that was kind of like Howard Dean's screaming thing. And that just is not going to be a win for anybody.
No.
So I would say go check it out, especially if you're a fan of Mamet's work. Definitely worth checking out.
Yeah, I'm actually really intrigued because especially by the part where you said that they introduced the movie as saying that it's fiction, that it's
boom, right away.
Sounds like a very nice.
Because I think it's an arena that we don't really participate in, but like speculative fiction, you know, you have all that with like World War II and all kinds of stuff like that. And I think this is just a different kind of speculative fiction. And it's actually, I've participated in writing it before just kind of as an exercise. And it can get really interesting really fast.
Mm-hmm. So just be aware of that. Don't use this. It's funny. Now we can revisit JFK. You know, do the research. If a film makes you want to do research and find out what is and what isn't correct and what's fair, then I think the film has more than done its job. So hopefully there's that.
Yeah, we'll have to watch that.
Okay. Okay.
By the way, can you imagine if they actually made a film with Chiwetel Ejiofor and Benedict Cumberbatch?
Wow.
Haven't they done that in England yet?
I don't know.
It would be the most English show ever, maybe.
If they could throw Engelbert Humperdinck in.
Isn't he? No, he's not in. No, that's Michael Fassbender in 12 Years a Slave.
So yeah.
But he probably keeps his clothes on in that one, Mon. Sorry. They all can't be shame.
His face is pretty good, though.
Yeah, it's not bad.
It's pretty.
Not bad. And like any quotes Lawrence of Arabia and Prometheus.
Yes. We still haven't seen Prometheus. I want to.
It's in the stores.
It is, we know.
You can check that out.
Probably okay. Right next to Star Trek now.
The sci-fi section. Okay, got some old titles, and these are ones, and this is kind of lightning round because we're in the home stretch. Would you buy this film on Blu-ray? And of course, depending on if there are new features, a lot of these are just kind of slapping a DVD onto a Blu-ray.
Kind of,
you get a better, slightly better sound and better picture. So we'll start with The Talented Mr. Ripley. The story's been told three times. Ripley's Game, Purple Noon, and now this.
Yeah. It is Minghella, so you know he's got that going for it. So
we do like Anthony Minghella.
I don't think Blu-ray would add anything to it.
It would make Jude Law prettier.
Well, yeah.
And Gwyneth and Matt pastier.
Yeah.
I do remember. I found a gaffe in that film. I like the film. I liked it. I think I enjoyed the film more than I did The English Patient because that was just about pretty people starving in a cave.
No, it was so good.
I wanted more.
He finally got me to watch it after like 8
really?
Years.
Really? I wanted more Naveen Andrews and Juliette Binoche's story than the pretty people that...
You know what?
I'm going to leave you in a cave and die. I'll be back in a minute.
Sorry. Read the book.
Okay.
Yeah, he keeps telling me.
Naveen Andrews isn't in the book, but you know.
Right, but it's not. It's unfortunately this isn't novel sociology.
Yeah.
I'm a jerk.
Read a book.
I read book. I just finished a book, and I got a new one in there. We saw it. It's about the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yay!
My
worthy
next
subject.
It's hard for me to find leisure read. It's all work related, one way, shape, or form. I know, hard life. I read books for a living.
Oh my gosh.
And do radio.
You must be so tired all the time.
It is. But I found a gaffe in this film that I just it was the nerd in me, and because the Jude Law character loves jazz. And there's some really nice music scenes. It's very cool. You hear, I think the soundtrack has Chet Baker. Mm-hmm. And who did the score? Do you remember who did the score for Ripley?
Oh, it was Gabriel Yared again.
Very good. That's right. He was always working with. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
So, but there's a scene in Jude Law's apartment where there's a Miles Davis album. And I knew it was a Miles Davis. It was a Miles Davis album from the 80s.
Oops.
Called Tutu. It was an extreme close-up of Miles's, and I know why they put it there. But I'm like, no, you should put The Birth of the Cool or any of the Prestige. That's not historically accurate.
I hate finding those little things.
Little tiny things. That kind of, like in Austin Land, there is a flashback at the very beginning. So we're assuming, I guess, Carrie Russell's in her mid-30s maybe, mm-hmm. and it's a flashback to her in high school. So a good, 17, 18 years. And she and her friend in high school do a fist bump.
That wasn't around 10 years ago.
No. So when you have a thing like that buried in your crawl, and that doesn't help you. And yes, I'm the guy who checks out the years and when songs are recorded.
Yep.
That frustrated me about pirate radio. Find songs from 1966.
Yeah.
I'm happy you got the rights to Jumpin' Jack Flash. It's not accurate.
Yeah.
So, all right. So there's Stanley, Mr. Ripley. Okay. Everyone's favorite movie to see before The Dentist, Marathon Man.
Definitely buy.
I have not seen Marathon Man.
Is it safe?
I didn't pull the audio. I should have pulled the audio on that. But okay. And of course, William Goldman will tell you to read the book as well.
Yes.
It's Dustin Hoffman, Roy Scheider, Laurence Olivier, William Devane, and Hoffman plays the title character. So first off, I love the fact that, Dustin Hoffman was a leading man in the 60s and 70s and apparently trains to run marathons, which I think anybody would see for 2.5. Okay, he's not that fast. 3.5 hours, maybe 4. And he finds out his brother worked for the CIA and that there's hidden diamonds that were hidden by the Nazis. And, of course, Laurence Olivier wins an Academy Award nomination by being everybody's favorite Nazi dentist. And there is, yes, the Is not, It Safe is...
Not the only time he played a retired Nazi in a film.
But not a Nazi dentist.
Oh, yeah, true.
What was the first time he played a Nazi?
Boys from Brazil.
He was a Nazi hunter.
Ah, right.
Gregory Peck, your guy,
Oh, sorry.
I'm in Brazil.
I misremembered.
Scout, we don't. We're not doing Atticus in The Boys from Brazil. That will get me in trouble. Forget what Monica says. We're not doing that. We'll do it for drinks later,
okay.
In private, but not here. But yeah, there is a gut wrenching scene where Hoffman's character is interrogated by Dr. Olivier, and the only thing he keeps asking is it safe? And Hoffman doesn't know what to say, and teeth and nerve endings are sacrificed, and it's just brutal.
And of course, it's the filming of that is the source of one of the greatest acting legends ever told.
Exactly. Now Hoffman at this time, well, he was a young and difficult to work with actor. Of course, that was made fun of in Tootsie.
Yeah.
And probably still, I think he even makes fun of himself today. But for for that scene, Hoffman's character stayed up all night.
Well, Hoffman himself stayed up
all night. Yeah, Hoffman stayed up all night. And they come in they're getting ready to do the shoot in the morning. And here comes Sir Larry. He comes in. He takes his coat off, has his tea and his cakes, and looks over and sees his poor co-star just a disheveled mess. and says, well, what are you doing, dear boy? And Hoffman says, I'm getting ready to get into character. And Brian, what did Sir Larry say to Dusty? Well,
try acting, dear boy.
Yeah, it's called acting. Try it sometime. Right, so...
That's awesome.
Yeah, well,
the quotations vary, and who knows if it ever actually happened.
But it makes for a good story.
It is.
And we have it here at Film Sociology. But it does, it is something I tell my acting students. High school and college age method actors are irritating.
Yeah.
They're really irritating.
The only, I still stand by my personal belief is that Daniel Day-Lewis is really the only guy who can get away with that.
Well, and I remember he did the same thing for In the Name of the Father, apparently.
Yes.
Where he stayed up for that. So, but the, you can only call me by my real, there was a fun picture of Daniel Day-Lewis at lunch as Lincoln in jeans. It's hard to call him Mr. President when you're in Levi's and a sweatshirt.
Yeah.
So anyway, I get it because I was there. I tried to do method as much as you could when you're a 17-year-old knucklehead. And I get it. You're young. You're insecure. You're afraid you'll lose the character. So you stay this way. I didn't talk to anybody. I didn't tell anybody to address me as Selsden during Noises Off because I'm 17 and playing an old man. much better done by Denham Elliott. But I get it. But hopefully over time and experience, you start to depend on that less.
You get a little actual technique under your belt.
Yeah, it really kind of bugs people around you, and you're hard to work with. So, yeah you should check out Marathon Man. It's a scary film. It's mid-70s, and it still packs a punch, especially, if anything else, for that scene.
Yep.
Okay.
And don't trust a proctologist who keeps asking you, is it safe? Don't do that. Okay. Oh, we talked about this composer earlier. Plug the blog again.
Cinematicmusic.blogspot.com.
And I always think of Brian when I go to the dollar bin at Half Price Books, because there's a lot of soundtracks that kind of
cheap.
And, well, we do whatever we can for the good of the cause. But I was going through, and I found a couple of them. I found John Williams' score to Saving Private Ryan, and I found one from a Bertolucci film I hadn't seen in a long, long time called The Sheltering Sky. And it was John Malkovich and Deborah Winger. Yes, it's 1990. And it was Bertolucci. This was his follow-up to The Last Emperor.
Indeed.
And I was like, well, who did that score? And I couldn't remember. And we finally looked it up, and you can say it better than I can.
Ryuichi Sakamoto.
And I looked around like, oh, yeah, Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. That was his first film score. That was the World War II film with David Bowie.
Yep.
Won an Oscar Oscar, Grammy, and Golden Globe for The Last Emperor.
Yep.
Not
wow.
bad. Black Rain, which I've played on the film show, I think, before.
Pretty good stuff.
Wuthering Heights. That's, the Ralph Fiennes version of Wuthering Heights. Wild Palms, Little Buddha. And a film that just came out on Blu-ray this week, Snake Eyes. The weird Brian De Palma single track fest with a pre-crazy Nicolas Cage and Gary Sinise. And it's kind of...
sure it was pre-crazy?
Okay, beyond crazy. Gotta pay for this castle and my bad financial choices.
Fair enough.
Ah.
So, and there's an assassination, and it's from many different angles and different levels. So,
The Rashomon effect.
The Rashomon effect, but it's De Palma, so it's longer tracks and weirder and, well, there's that.
And lots of fancy camera work.
Lots of family cancer work. Okay. Joyride. No.
Drawn a blank.
This was Lili Sobieski, Paul Walker, Paul Zahn.
No.
No on who?
You don't need to buy that on Blu-ray.
Oh, okay, that's fine. The original 1958, The Fly.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he was, yeah.
Oh, yeah, Vincent Price. Yeah. Vincent Price in the starring, not as creepy as previous Price work. So there's that. Ooh, I saw this in the theater. Nobody needs this. No, you don't need this. Sliver. Sharon Stone.
No.
Yeah. William Baldwin.
Also known as Joe Esterhaz Jumps the Shark.
Oh, that was bad. That was really bad. Okay, so let's move away from those. Move on to, Jennifer Eight. Andy Garcia, Blind Uma Thurman.
I've never seen it.
John Malkovich. Brian's giving the...
Masu Mano's hand.
Mesa. Yeah, just kind of, not really. Next Friday... Apparently not Friday or the Friday after, but next Friday.
I know what you did next Friday. Wait,
that's a different thing.
I don't think that's... It's kind of like if you're watching that for the reasons I think you are, then you probably don't need it on Blu-ray.
Okay. A double bill from the 70s. The Richard Chamberlain version of The Count of Monte Cristo.
Ah, yes. I just saw that on Blu-ray.com. I haven't seen it, but hey, I'll watch it.
And on the other one, Man Friday.
Yes.
With Peter O'Toole and Richard Roundtree.
The true story of Robinson Crusoe.
Right. And of course, any non-Shaft film with Roundtree, I'm like, oh, let's check that out. And by the way, we're still waiting for Inchon to come out on DVD. No, nobody really is. So. I saw that in the theaters with my dad, and it was terrible. I was young, and I knew it was bad. This is one, I don't even know if this got a DVD release, so I can't remember if it's both. You remember Alamo Bay? You will not, Monica, but
no.
1984, Louis Malle,
okay.
Ed Harris, and Amy Madigan, and it's a fishing community, Alamo Bay, Texas, and it's a pretty intense drama of what happens with a local Texan fisherman clashing against the Vietnamese community who have taken over the fishing business.
Hmm.
So,
nope.
But it's kind of this. I think this was Louis Malle's follow up to Atlantic City. So. But a really, it's young, scary Ed Harris. And this is, I think, right after The Right Stuff.
Nice.
So there is that. Because the movie is coming out, the remake, the second remake is coming out in a couple of months, the 1976 film Carrie.
Yes. Yeah, they did a made-for-TV remake, didn't they?
They did.
Yeah, well, you that, need that definite, on Blu-ray. Yeah, you definitely
speaking
do.
Speaking of Brian De Palma and Weird.
Speaking of Brian De Palma, I remember the trailers for this when it first came out, and it spooked me.
Oh, and don't forget the musical.
Book,
yeah, the musical with Betty Buckley, who everyone's favorite gym teacher. Right.
And the book is just so, it's a reason it launched Stephen King's career.
How was the adaptation? Because I've never read it.
I personally like to, with pretty much all Stephen King adaptations, I like to look at them as separate entities. I think that they do a good job with the story that he wrote. But I try not to think of it as an adaptation because inevitably I love Stephen King in a way that most people think he's kind of weird. I think they did a really good job.
And I was trying to explain to Emma because of course Chloe Martz is playing the title role.
Yeah, I'm excited about that.
I hate to say it because we film critics we rant and we rave about remakes and nothing's original. Blah, 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 blah. But the fact that you have Chloe Martz, you have Julianne Moore, and it's from Kimberly Pierce who directed Boys Don't Cry.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a lady directing. You have two actresses. No disrespect to Piper Laurie and Sissy Spacek, but a little wider age range, and they're really good actors. And Chloe just keeps getting
she's
better.
Great. I first saw her on 30 Rock, and her scenes with Alec Baldwin are just. Her timing is priceless.
Emma has not seen her as Hit Girl. Emma knows her from Diary of a Wimpy Kid.
Oh, yeah.
Right, and Hugo. So, I'm intrigued about it. But that being said, Piper Laurie and Sissy Spacek are really strong as mother and daughter, even though they're, like, I think 9 years apart.
Yeah.
It's like The Graduate. And,
that's okay. Lawrence Harvey was older than Angela Lansbury.
Manchurian Candidate. My other favorite one was Julianne Moore was the daughter of Francis Fisher in Rules of Attraction. And then finally, my wife got to play, the last time she played Mrs. Cratchit, the actress who played Martha, apparently Mrs. Cratchit was 9 when she had her oldest child.
Oh, well, wow.
It was Victorian England.
Kristen Lennox. And then the next year, she played Mrs. Cratchit. So that was cool. Okay, out on Criterion, and I just, I know we love the Criterion, because you get your money's worth with the Criterion. And I just, first off, La Cage aux Folles, the original La Cage aux Folles. Not the Birdcage. But this is one I want to letting a friend borrow the DVD because he wanted non-Bond spy movies. 1965 Martin Ritz, The Spy Who Came In From the Cold. Based on the Jean Le Carré novel. Richard Burton, actually in a good film in the mid-60s. Martin Ritz directed it. And it's a lot of tan raincoats and rainy trips to the market. In black and white. And it's a job. And it's just a job. And Burton's really good in this. And I think, everybody talks about, and I'm fascinated by the Liz and Dick movies, whether they work together or not. At least with every Spy Who Came In From the Cold and Equus, he had a dozen Bluebeards and Radon Rommel and Boom and, just really, he was getting a big check to afford Liz's lifestyle. And Liz was the same way. But this was one, he's really good in it. It's a low-key movie, so if you don't want over-the-top ridiculous action stuff, you're not going to get it here. It's Martin Ritt, who, of course, directed a bunch of films like Hud and Norma Rae. And he actually acted – he did direct it. I'm sorry. He appears in The End of the Game, which is a film that was produced and directed by Maximilian Schell. Which was a crime drama from the mid-70s with John Voight and Jacqueline Bisset. And he acted in that. But he also did a film. I saw this on TCM. Thank you, TCM. I think it's called No Money, No Down Payment. And it's about suburbia in the 50s. And it's people moving out and in Los Angeles. And you have a Jim Hunter, everyone's favorite babyface Christ. Here's a couple, Cameron Mitchell and Joanne Woodward. Way to go, Cam. Young Pat Hingle's in this. And Tony Randall. Tony Randall's really good in this. This is a guy, as a car salesman, who's in over his head financially. And it's three separate stories, three couples, and the intertwinings with each other and the angst of suburbia and their own marriages. It's actually really good.
That does sound really
And it's an underrated. It's like late 50s, so look for that. Okay, I think we got some final words, but Brian, what do you think you'll blog about next week?
Oh, probably some of the work of a young composer named Bear McCreary.
Cool.
Oh, yeah, Bear is awesome. He's a great composer. He did the soundtracks for Battlestar Galactica, and that's probably his best-known stuff. It's phenomenal. His use of international instruments is very cohesive. It's really great.
So check out Brian's blog, and here's some words to live by.
Silent Breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Thanks, guys. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Anytime.
Cool. And until next time, go see a good movie. You deserve it. And congratulations to Kobe and Bianca.
Yay!
They're getting married on Sunday. And don't take him to Austin Land. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. See you later.